Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. It's great to have Anne Summers back at the Sydney Institute. As I recall, the last time she was here, Dr. Summers was discussing her memoirs. But she's been here on a number of occasions, and as I said, it's great to have her back. This time to coincide with the publication of her most recent book, The Lost Mother, A Story of Art and Love. Before Dr. Summers commences, I should introduce her briefly. Anne Summers is the author of Dams, Whores and God's Police, Gamble for Power, Ducks on the Pond and The End of Equality, among other books. She has edited the landmark American feminist magazine Ms., as well as Good Weekend in Australia, and she's also written for the Sydney Morning Herald and the Australian Financial Review and many other publications. Anne Summers has been an advisor to Prime Ministers Bob Hawke and Paul Keating. She's chaired the board of Greenpeace International, and she's been deputy president of Sydney's Powerhouse Museum. Dr. Summers lives in Sydney, and as I said, her most recent book is The Lost Mother. And tonight, the topic for the talk is Searching for the Lost Mother, the Painting and the Person. Anne Summers, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Gerard. Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll try and keep the volume up, try and talk over those Sydney buses. They're never there when you want one. No doubt I'm probably going to be over-welcome tonight. Very glad to be here to have a chance to talk about my gorgeous new book. Speaking of the cover, I'm others to judge the contents, but I'm thrilled to death with the way it looks, and I'm very happy with the publisher for rendering the portrait of my mother in such a gorgeous fashion. Those of you who might have read Good Weekend a few weekends ago will know that the book is about my search for a lost painting of my mother, or at least that is what it started being about. It quickly became a lot more than that. The book has been described as being part art history, part detective story, and part meditation on the relations between mothers and daughters. Something for everyone, in other words. It's a story that has several beginnings, but as yet, no end. It begins the first time in 1933 in the Melbourne beachside suburb of Brighton, where my mother, then a 10-year-old schoolgirl, had just attended Sunday Mass at St. Joan of Arc's church. As she is leaving the church, a young woman approaches her, says she is an artist and would like to paint her portrait. Did she think her parents would allow it? It begins again in 2005, after the sudden death of my mother a few months earlier, when the portrait came to me. Although I was very familiar with this portrait, which has hung on the wall of my parents' various houses for more than 30 years, it somehow looks different when I hang it on the wall of my living room in Sydney. Perhaps it looks sharper because it is on a simple white wall, whereas my mother always had it hanging on a patterned papered wall. Or perhaps it's taken on a new and more compelling aura because my mother is now dead. I stand back to get a better look. There is my mother as a 10-year-old looking down at me. She's dressed in what she described as her good clothes, a brown pleated skirt, black stockings, a blue jumper and a red beret. Her plaits hang down in front of her and are obscured by the large book she's holding. It is a children's version of Alice in Wonderland, but it is the eyes that draw you into the picture. They are big and blue, clear and mesmerising, staring out at me with an expression of astonishing wisdom and maturity. It must have been, I realised, these eyes that attracted the artist to the schoolgirl. She must have seen, or perhaps wanted to see, not just a girlish face, but something else, something sage and eternal. I found it hypnotic and alluring, but also challenging. It held a story, I knew that much. And although I was not sure what the story was or would become, I decided that I wanted to delve into it and see what I could find. I was probably motivated by grief and by the need for atonement, to make up in death for what I had been unable to achieve in life, a warm and close relationship with my mother. At the same time, I sensed, as a journalist and as an historian, that the history of this painting might reveal some surprising things. It turned out I was right. Fortunately, some years earlier, Mum had written out an account of how she had been approached by the artist. She had done this in the early 1990s, after we had learnt that the C. Parkin, who had signed the painting of my mother in 1933, was in fact Constance Stokes, a distinguished artist of some renown. I had urged Mum to write an account of how she'd come to be painted and how, almost 40 years later, the painting was finally brought into our family by her mother, my grandmother. I'd heard the story many times, but I knew that I would forget the details, especially when my mother was no longer around to recount this extraordinary story of circumstance and serendipity. I brought out this little memoir now and read it again. Although I had read it many, many times over the years, this time I saw something I had never before focused on. Constance painted two portraits of me, my mother had written. One in the clothes which she had first seen me in, yes, there it was on my wall. The second painting, that stopped me. The second painting she had written was done as the Madonna, a veil draped over my head and shoulders. And what happened to that, I do not know. Mum as the Madonna, what an unusual thing to do, even for an artist who had recently returned from the museums of Italy, where paintings of pubescent girls as Madonnas were commonplace. I don't think too many artists in Melbourne in 1933 were painting Madonnas. I decided then that as well as trying to find out more about the one on my wall, I would also search for this painting. I would seek out the missing Madonna, the lost mother, and hope that if I found it, I might learn something more about my mother through the image created by an artist more than 70 years earlier. If she had been able to create such a compelling image of my mother in her red beret, I could only imagine what the artist had been able to do with my mother as the Virgin Mary. My story has three central characters. My mother, of course, the artist, Constance Stokes, who painted her, and the mysterious and ultimately tragic Russian collector, Lydia Mortel, who bought the two portraits. In following the story of the painting and of these three women, I encountered an astonishing array of other people. I could hardly have foreseen that my search for a portrait that was painted in Melbourne in 1933 would involve encounters with such luminaries as Anna Pavlova, Fyodor Chaliapin, the Ballet Russe, and Nellie Melba, as well as locals such as Archbishop Mannix and Dame Enid Lyons, let alone Woodrow Wilson, Hitler, Stalin, and the Foreign Minister of Latvia, to name just some of those who became part of my story. Nor could I have imagined that tracking that painting would take me from Melbourne to Moscow, from Canberra to Cairo, to Paris, New York, Riga, Hawaii, and even to Hollywood. Sadly, these travels were mostly virtual rather than actual, a testament to the modern miracle of internet-based research. I quickly learned that the painting on my wall in Sydney was called Alice, rather than Girl in Red Beret, which is what my family had always thought it was its title. It was, the artist said in an interview near the end of her life, an Alice in Wonderland image, and soon it had me going down all sorts of rabbit holes into previously undreamt of wonderlands. Once I began my investigations, I learned a great deal about the artist Constance Stokes. She had been one of Australia's leading artists in the 1940s and 1950s, up there with Arthur Boyd, Sidney Nolan, and her contemporary in the George Bell Group, Russell Drysdale. Indeed, when Stokes and Drysdale exhibited together, as they did frequently in the late 40s and 1950s, it was Stokes' works that were the higher priced and got the most attention. Remarkably, in 1947, Stokes' farmer's family, hung alongside Drysdale's The Drover's Wife. The two paintings are very similar in style as well as subject matter. Yet it is Drysdale who is credited with developing the strong red colours and the thick glazes that both artists used. Stokes' role in the evolution, perhaps even the creation, of these techniques is totally overlooked and forgotten. Stokes had enjoyed tremendous critical and commercial success from the 1930s until the 1980s. She was collected by all the public institutions in this country, with the exception of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and was revered by private collectors such as Duke Murdoch, Joseph Burke and Daryl Lindsay. People put their names down to buy her paintings and drawings. She was admired by people like Sir Kenneth Clarke, who, on a visit to Melbourne in 1949, described her as one of the best draftsmen of the 20th century. Stokes had been part of Australia's entry in the Venice Biennale in 1953, and she had been one of the painters to be included in a special exhibition, 12 Australian Artists in London, in 1953, to mark the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. And both of those representations came after her first, perhaps major coup, and that was to have one of her paintings exhibited at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York in 1942 or 41, in the first ever collection of Australian modern art to be sent to America. So, what had happened to her? Why hadn't I heard of her? Why wasn't she a household name like the male artists who hung alongside her? All of whom, I might add, had all been knighted. She received no recognition whatsoever. I had not even seen her name mentioned in the context of the women artists such as Grace Fossenden Smith, Margaret Preston, Stella Bowen, Clarice Beckett and others whose reputations and works had been rescued in recent years, often as a result of feminist scholarship. Why had Stokes remained lost? I soon found out that she had married and had three children. This was highly unusual for a woman who wanted a career as an artist. None of the women I have just referred to had children, and only one of them, Margaret Preston, was married. Stokes felt that having a family held her back. "You're half mother and half painter," she complained. She never reconciled these two parts of herself. An important part of my story involves trying to understand what happened to Stokes' career as an artist, to the choices she made between creativity and love, and the consequences of those choices. Although I had very little knowledge of the art world, it became necessary for me to step into it to try to understand why Stokes had been dropped from the canon. The theme of loss soon became central to my story. Each of these women was lost in their own way. My mother's portrait as the Madonna was lost, as was my relationship with her. Constance Stokes was very much the lost artist, someone whose brilliant star has faded into virtual obscurity today. As for Lydia Mortill, well, she lost everything. Lydia's story is one of the extraordinary byways that I explored, not knowing where it would take me or how relevant it would be to my search. Lydia Alexandrovna Klyavin was born in Orel in Russia in 1893 to a noble landowning family. She was educated at the Stroganovsky College in Moscow, where she received a gold medal for her studies in political economy. She later went to Paris, where she studied music and languages. Lydia enters my story early in 1916, when she somehow found herself in Cairo, where she married a young Australian officer who had been wounded at Gallipoli on Anzac Day. Lydia's new husband, Captain Dudley Hardy, was sent to the Somme a few weeks after their marriage and 8 months later was killed in the Battle of Pozières. Lydia Hardy, aged 24, was alone in the world, unable to be reunited with her mother in Russia, where revolution was imminent, nor to return to Paris. She got in touch with her in-laws in Australia, who quite likely didn't even know they had a daughter-in-law, let alone a Russian one, and in 1917 made her way to Kadena, a tiny town on South Australia's York Peninsula. This desolate town must have been a great shock to the system of the tiny, vivacious and sophisticated woman who had shone in Paris and in Cairo. She decided to get out of Kadena as soon as she could, And according to a family member who actually knew Lydia and who I interviewed to marry a rich man, it took her 2 years. Lydia Hardy married William Mortell in Melbourne in 1919. She was 27, he was 51, and immensely wealthy. Before long, the Mortells were stars of Melbourne society, especially in the area of the arts. They entertained every visiting arts dignitary at their mansion, Tate Cregan in Hawthorne, including Pavlova. Their parties were legendary, as was their art collection. Among the many paintings Lydia bought were the two portraits of my mother. And it was at one of these parties where a visiting French actress was photographed by the Melbourne Herald admiring a portrait of a young girl on the wall of the mansion that my grandmother learnt where the painting of her daughter was. It was because Lydia had bought the two paintings that I decided she was central to my story, even when following her meant going down paths that seemed to lead me away from my search. To Latvia, for instance, where I learnt that Lydia's sister, Natalia, was married to a man by the name of Vilhelm Muntis, who was Latvia's Minister for Foreign Affairs, and who in 1938 and 1939 was responsible for negotiating directly with both Hitler and Stalin about the fate of this tiny Baltic state. The geopolitics of Latvia became relevant to my story in March 1939, on the day that Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, when the Mortills suddenly sold their Melbourne mansion, complete with its art collection, and headed for Europe, to Latvia. There were two extraordinary things, there were at least two extraordinary things about this action. Firstly, just 5 years earlier, Lydia Mortill had refused my grandmother's entreaty to be able to buy the portrait that we now know is called Alice. But she told my grandmother, if ever she was disposing of her painting, she would let her know. Evidently, the 1939 sale occurred in too much of a hurry for her to do that. Secondly, why on earth would the couple travel to Europe just as war was breaking out? In fact, the ship that they travelled on normally had 600 passengers. On this particular voyage, there were just 60. William Mortill was now 71 years old, not an age when most people would embark on a potentially hazardous trip. Whatever it was that was drawing them to Latvia, whatever it was that impelled them to sell everything, to abandon their precious art collection, must have been very compelling indeed. Why had they done this? And why, 6 years earlier, had Lydia bought not one, but two portraits of my mother? Did my mother remind her of someone? Someone she left behind in Russia? Her little sister, perhaps? There are many mysteries in this story. Some of them remain unsolved. I'd now like to spend a few minutes talking about how I researched this book, because it presented some unusual challenges, even for someone who has a background as a journalist and as an historian. There were two principal problems. There appeared to be very little information available on the public records about the key characters, and key archival information that ought to have been available was simply missing. The first problem was similar to that faced by women and other historians in the 1970s, when they began to search out the lives of women who had been, to use the phrase we used then, hidden from history. These were women who had no official existence, women who entered the public record only when they were born, when they were married, and when they died. Other sources were needed to try to delve into their lives. I could talk about this all night because I love research, but I won't bore you to death. I'll just give you a few examples of how I was able to unearth information about the people in my book. In the case of Lydia Mortill, there seemed to be no information at all. When I first began this research, I knew nothing at all about her, not even her name. In fact, I had a different name for her. My mother's little memoir had said that the woman who purchased her portrait was a Mrs. Mortell, T-E-L-L. Mum was careful about spelling, so I was inclined to believe her, especially after I discovered that the State Library of Victoria had some beautiful photographs of a Russian-looking woman who was identified as Mrs. Mortell. However, there were other clues pointing to a Mrs. W. Mortill, and I could not be sure which was right. In the end, I resolved the matter by checking the title deeds of the Hawthorne Mansion, Tate Cregan, which revealed the house was owned by William Mortill. That solved it. I informed the State Library of Victoria, and they believed that they had the wrong name in their catalogue, that I believed they had the wrong name. They believed me, and they changed the records. But although I had resolved the last name, I still did not know anything about her beyond the suggestion that she was Russian. I did not know her first name. My first port of call then was the excellent BDM Birth, Deaths and Marriages records for Victoria, which, luckily for me, was the only state that has this resource online, fully accessible and downloadable for a fee. It took only minutes to ascertain that there was no marriage between William Moore Till and a Russian woman, although there was a marriage certificate for a William Moore Till and a Lydia Hardy. That did not seem to be relevant. But, I reasoned, the Moore Tills may not have married in Melbourne, but perhaps Mrs. Moore Till had died there. And sure enough, I quickly found a death certificate for Olivia Alexandrovna Moore Till, who had died at the age of 48 in 1942. I went back to the 1919 marriage certificate and discovered that Moore Till had married Olivia Alexandrovna Hardy. I had the right woman. And her name was Lydia. I can't say Harry, sorry. To finally have a name that is born. Such a great name. But who is Mr. Hardy, her first husband? I might never have known were it not for the research genius of Elena Gova, a Russian academic who lives in Canberra, and who I contacted to ask for help in trying to find out more about Lydia. Gova was compiling a database of all Russians in early 20th century Australia, and while Lydia Moore Till was not on it, she had lots of other suggestions as to places I might look to learn more about the woman who had bought the paintings of my mother. None of these led anywhere, but one night, Gova had what must be called a eureka moment. She has done a lot of work on the Russian Anzacs, of whom there are quite a number, and she knows her way around the Australian War Memorial and the National Archives of Australia. And something made her search for a death record for a Mr. Hardy on the day that, according to the marriage certificate of the Moore Tills, Lydia became a widow. She was instantly rewarded. Soon I had an entire dossier on Captain Dudley Freeman Hardy, who had been killed in the Second Battle of the Somme on August the 18th, 1916. Australian military records and the quite extensive British Red Cross files on him are online and instantly available. From them I learnt the very sad story of how the young Russian woman came to be in Australia. The second form of research that I used extensively was the interview. I was fortunate that many of the people in my story were either still alive or their descendants were, and many of them proved to be relatively easy to trace. Maybe not quite old, in fact. In many instances, material I learned from interviews sent me back to the archives to learn more. In one case, someone mentioned that she thought William Moore Till had owned yellow cabs. I learned that yellow cabs had been a listed company, so it was easy to find their records in the ASX archives at the University of Melbourne. From these I found documents that showed that the source of Moore Till's great wealth had been the sale of his Melbourne Carrying Company to Yellow Express Carriers, which owned yellow cabs. There were many other such examples of research serendipity, such as finding the actual receipt for the sale of the second portrait of my mother to Mrs. Moore Till in a box of papers held by Constance Stokes' son. Let me just say that the book was tremendous fun to research. And just one other example that's not in my question that I'd like to just give you was an example where I couldn't find what should have been, I had hoped, a very obvious set of records, and that is that the Grand Mansion Tay Cregan, when it was sold in March 1939 by the Moore Tills, it was purchased by the Catholic Church in a transaction that was personally driven by Archbishop Mannix. And the church held the building for 30 years and sold it again in 1969. And I went to the Catholic archives in Melbourne and was what I thought was a very simple request. Could I please see the records relating to the initial purchase of the house? And I was presuming there would be an inventory of the artworks and, you know, I'd find the paintings there and that would be that. And to my absolute astonishment and horror, there are no records whatsoever. The Mannix apparently ordered them all to be destroyed, as was his wont. And apparently there are virtually no records of Mannix at all. But what was even more remarkable was that long after Mannix had gone, the sale of the church, the sale of this mansion by the Catholic Church in 1969 was not recorded either. So there are just absolutely no transactions of fairly substantial business transactions by the church. In 1939, they paid £6,000 for this house, which is a considerable amount of money. And when they sold the house in 1969, they got £123,000 for it, again, a substantial amount of money. And there's just no records anywhere of what happened to all of this stuff. So, just as I said, the book was tremendous fun to research. As a journalist, I like nothing better than a good story, and this one had everything. Great characters, unexpected plot twists, an emotional thread, some guilty characters. The more Till fortune was built on a crime, as most fortunes are. An emotional thread, plenty of intrigue, and some as yet unresolved mysteries. It was an unusual book for me. It covers subjects such as art and war and international diplomacy, which I had not written about before. It's an immensely complex story spanning well over a century and with a large cast of characters. But if it was fun to research, it was hell to write, at least until I was able to get the narrative structure worked out. That took a very long time. I hope that I've got it right, in the sense that the book is a good read now, but you're definitely part of that. So just to conclude, I've mentioned already that early into my research, I discovered the portrait on my wall, which we had always believed was called Girl in Red Beret, was in fact called Alice. I soon realised that this was a reference to Alice in Wonderland, because the artist had placed an Alice book in my mother's hands. A book I later discovered was the artist's, something she had retained since her childhood. At the age of 9, she'd contracted diphtheria, and while bedridden, she had first encountered Alice and her Wonderland. Alice, the portrait of my mother, had first been exhibited in October 1933 in the artist's first one-woman show at the Decoration Gallery in Little Collins Street, Melbourne. And it had hung alongside a painting that was called A Saint. I soon had to conclude that the painting Mum had thought was a Madonna was most likely a saint. It was still a religious image, but it did not have quite the same potency of an image of the Virgin Mary. It also upset my theory about what the artist might have had in mind when she painted my mother. I realised that these two portraits of Mum were painted just weeks before the artist's wedding. She married Eric Stokes in August 1933, and that they were the last pictures the artist painted as a single woman. It is likely the portraits represented some of her anxieties about her future. Perhaps she placed the picture book, Alice and the White Rabbit, in my mother's hands to signify her yearning for the freedom to escape down the rabbit hole that would soon be denied to her. Painting a young girl as the Madonna, as she told my mother she was doing, might have been a sign of her acceptance that, for a Catholic woman at least, marriage almost inevitably meant motherhood. Or maybe not. Maybe the artist had something else entirely in mind when she painted the second picture. I conclude the book by speculating that perhaps the second picture of my mother depicts her as Joan of Arc, the saint for whom the church where the artist first met my mother was named. Joan of Arc was a new saint. She'd been canonised just 13 years before, in 1920. And unlike most women saints, she'd been honoured not just for her piety, her chastity and her martyrdom, but because she was a fighter. She epitomised the modern woman. It's likely that the young Constance Parkin admired this new saint, and it is more than probable that as she went to gallery school each day for 3 years in the late 1920s, that she stepped past the massive statue of Jeanne d'Arc that stands in the forecourt of the State Library of Victoria. It made sense that the artist would choose a young girl as a sitter for Alice and for Joan of Arc, as both of them were just girls themselves. Alice Liddell was 10 and Joan of Arc just 12 when she heard voices telling her to banish the English from France. My mother was, the artist must have felt, the perfect child to represent these valiant women, and she made two portraits. All this time I was looking for a Madonna, a mother. Perhaps I should have been looking for something else, a saint, but a very modern one, independent, assertive, free, something that neither my mother nor the artist Constance Stokes, because of their generation and their circumstances, were allowed to be. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Everyone here in on the back, so if you can't just get out. So it comes to the question of discussion. Janet Grundy, bespoke bookseller to the Sydney Institute, has got copies of The Lost Mother, which the Herald got around the wrong way, didn't it?
Yes, the Herald took the picture, yes. When you said, in the book, reproduced the photograph of the Melbourne Herald that shows them visiting French actress admiring the portrait on the wall. But the Herald's got the picture around the wrong way. It's facing that way instead of... It's facing that way instead of this way.
They reversed the picture.
Yeah,
so it's the negative, yeah.
So the book would have been... You wouldn't have to read the title of the book.
The book's in a right hand, whereas the book should be in a left hand. Mm-hmm. But there's great illustrations in this book. So, just on your final question, on your final point, I mean, you essentially say that the artist and your mother weren't able to be successful, but would they have looked at it that way? I mean, would your mother say that she was unsuccessful? She seems to be reasonably successful for me, and she's quite a good sort, if you don't mind saying. Both as a young girl and as a young
girl. I think it's the word success. I think it's to do with choices and opportunities and things that she might have done had life been different for her. And I mean, one of the sources of conflict, I think, between her and me, particularly when I was younger, was that she was very disappointed and perhaps even angry that I chose not to have children, whereas she had six children, and she used to, I think, be very disappointed at me for this choice. But later in life, she said to me that I was very lucky that I didn't have children, because I had a lot of freedoms and opportunities that had been denied to her. So I don't think that she regretted having her children, but I think she regretted the opportunities that denied to her. And there is no doubt Constance Stokes felt the same way that she talked about in every interview she ever gave, so much so that, I feel a bit sorry for her children. You have to constantly read that they, held their mother back from achieving artistic greatness. I think in fact with Stokes what happened was that because she had three children, this was only one of the things that held her back. There are other things, I think, inside herself. But she never stopped painting, or more importantly, drawing. She was a magnificent drawer, and she drew. There wasn't time to paint. She could always draw. But her output wasn't very large. She painted three or four paintings a year, which isn't really enough. Just the problem was not that she stopped painting or that her paintings weren't good, but there just weren't enough of them. And the dealers used to be constantly demanding more and more today we call product, probably. And she just couldn't do it because of the other responsibilities.
I'd like to ask you a question, if you don't mind, about Tay Cregan, out of curiosity. I remember visiting them, in the 40s when I was a kid, and for a fair or something. And what really surprised me was that the Catholic Church had bought it, and as I understood, and I might be wrong, but they were bought out of, there was an order of Dutch nuns who came out to use Tay Cregan to train as a finishing school for girls. His father might be in the diplomatic corps.
Not quite. Definitely was the Grail. The Grail are very, and the fact that there's another kind of interesting byway of the story, on a quest for a painting, and in fact the Grail were named after the possible quest, were the custodians of at least one of the paintings, possibly both of them. During 30 years after the Mortuals sold tape. The Grail were actually not nuns, they were a lay order of women that were created in Holland in the early 20s, and they were basically formed as an apostolic lay movement designed to fight the rising youth movements of both the communists and the fascists. And they were, there's a lot of stuff about the history in the book that's just so extraordinarily fascinating. They took part in some big Eucharistic Congress in Ireland in the late 20s, I think it was. The Bishop of Wagga Wagga happened to be there, and he's completely fascinated by these women, and they used to wear clashing colours, like orange and green and yellow uniforms, and wave flags and do folk dancing and all sorts of very un-Irish things. And he really admired their very aggressive attitude to trying to youth. And so... he invited them to Australia. And what happened is six of them came to Sydney in forget the date right now, but this infuriated Archbishop Mannix because he said, you know, they shouldn't be in Sydney, Melbourne. And Archbishop Kelly in Sydney bought them a fabulous house from the Jesuits up in Greenwich somewhere. So that's why Mannix had to find a better house in Melbourne.
He sure did.
And what they did, they started off trying to, it was never a finishing school. It was meant to be a school that prepared Catholic women for motherhood and to be good wives and, you know, the way things were back then. I actually went to live there in 1963. By the time I went to live there, they were only as a hostel for girls, you know, basically girls who are either students or working and just needed somewhere to live because their families weren't in Melbourne. And although there was a little bit of a religious component to it, there was certainly an issue with the school. They were trying to keep us, you know, in the Catholic Church, but they only just succeeded in that for very long. But they're still around. I mean, the woman that I had most to do with in Tate Creek in 1963 lives in North Sydney today, and I've had a lot to do with this.
Can I ask a question about Constance Stokes?
Sure.
To what extent was her role as a mother the thing that held her back, or was it that her husband wasn't really very interested in what her life was about? Because I'm interested in this partly because of doing a biography of Enid Lyons, where she had 12 children, and it never stopped her doing anything in public she wanted to do, but that was partly because her husband encouraged her to do that. So he was a banker, wasn't he, or something, Constance Stokes?
And
to what extent was that lack of support? Because I'm interested also because a friend of my daughter's, who's an artist, and she's coming on quite well, she's in her mid-30s, gave up a relationship a couple of years ago because the lawyer man that she was with wasn't very interested in her art, and she was determined to pursue her art, as if, you know, you have to have support. Could you talk about Constance?
Well, I think with Stokes, I mean, it's true that a lot of things are against her. I mean, her husband absolutely adored her, but he was not completely uninterested in her art. So, like, he tolerated it. When they first came back from their honeymoon in 1934, she said there's no way in the world she's going to live in the suburbs. She was going to live in the Bohemian part of Melbourne. They lived in a place called Number 9 Collins Street, which is a purpose-built artist studios where many, many famous artists have lived and worked, and they were there for a while until she got pregnant, and then they had to move to the suburbs. But I think that what Eric Stokes is at, Eric Stokes is a very famous family in Melbourne. Anyone from here from Melbourne would probably have heard of Stokes Engineering. They made all the medals in the wars, they made all the currency, they made the lights outside Parliament House in Melbourne. They did every kind of sort of metal and foundry stuff that was done in those. So very, very wealthy and very well known, but not that interested in art. So while Eric supported her and encouraged her, and she had the very best of materials and the best brushes and the best paper and everything, he wasn't that interested. So that was one problem. In some of the interviews she's given, she said that, you know, his family was very conservative. She had to really build her, had to be suppressed. I think the other problem too, and there's a very interesting BA thesis has been written about Stokes, which I was fortunate enough to be allowed to use. And the thesis of this scholar is that one of the things that really stymied her was her need to be respectable, or her decision to be respectable. I mean, they lived in Durack. They had, you know, a lot of money. She used to wear twinset and pearls in her studio. So she didn't really look like an artist. She didn't behave like an artist. She wasn't having affairs and abortions and smoking dope, or, you know, doing, she never went to Heidi, for example, and, you know, hung out with the Reeds and the Nolans and all the people were having a fun time. And I think, you know, to some extent she has actually been judged by her lifestyle rather than by her work. And obviously her lifestyle is incredibly boring. If you you want artists to be flamboyant, nerds, amora types, and and she wasn't like that. But I mean, I find her lifestyle not very interesting either, but I find her work very impressive. And one of the things I think is quite challenging about her life is, you know, we should be judging her on her work and not on the fact that she didn't look like an artist or didn't live like an artist. This was one of her huge struggles, and I was very, very lucky to have access to all her diaries and letters, and just to read, you know, even if it weren't her 70s, she was writing about herself as a failure, someone who had never been able to realise her potential. She felt so bitter that she'd never been able to break free of these things. So I think that she was a woman of tremendous creativity and tremendous talent, but she wasn't a risk taker. And she would never really, maybe, you know, to be a really great artist, you have to just abandon everything, and she couldn't do that. That doesn't mean she wasn't a very good artist. And it's still no reason to kind of, you know, forget all about her, in my view.
Robin, yeah.
Thank you very much for that talk. What came across at the end when you were speculating about conflicts by his expectation, I guess, was that the generalisations that can be made in that, looking at my parents' generation and the frustration that I saw in my own mother, that I saw the creativity suddenly coming out when she was a bit over the age of some pressure caused by society's expectations. But I didn't realise that until I saw my mother in her what people would call an active old age.
Well, I think that's very true, and I think that's only true of my mother, who she was widowed for 17 years, same time, and really surprised me, you know, by doing some of the things she did. Great reader, but she wasn't particularly educated, hadn't had any. She enrolled in the University of Third Age, studied French drama, which is quite an extraordinary thing for her to have done, and that was a bit of a clue that she felt dissatisfied with, you know, with what she'd had, and she wanted. And I think in the case of Stokes, I mean, what happened with Stokes was when her husband died quite suddenly in 1962, and when he died, I mean, she had been so completely dependent on him, she didn't have a clue. She didn't know how to drive a car, she couldn't balance a checkbook, or she didn't even write a check. She had no idea about the finances. She was horrified to discover that there was a huge mortgage. The rest of Stokes' family wouldn't come to her aid, so she was children were late teens, but she was in terrible trouble, and she had no alternative but to sort of paint her way out of trouble. And what's so incredible about her is, you know, the paintings of my mother that were shown in her first One Woman show in 1933, her second One Woman show was 1964, and that was a show where she painted her way out of debt. It took her 2 years to put it together, and it was an absolute critical and commercial sellout. You know, she did so well, so I've made a huge amount of money from it. And that also, I think, brought her confidence back. And she completely changed the style of painting. She changed everything about the way she worked. And whether that was to do with her husband's dying, or whether it was to do with just the natural evolution of her work, or a combination, or something. I mean, I'm not an art expert. Other people have to look at that. But it is very, very marked, I think, that she changed so radically in the 60s. They were there for a couple of months. I don't know exactly what happened. I don't know what they did, but I'm assuming that they took a lot of money with them. I think their idea was probably to try and get her mother out, her sister out, sister's children, probably trying to, you know, the idea probably would have been to try and smuggle them out, which is why they needed a lot of money. In the end, I think it was just impossible to do it. They were just too high profile. I mean, the Minister for Foreign Affairs is not someone who can smuggle out of the country easily, or his wife. And once the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, if I've got the name right, once that was signed in, I think that was it September?
August 39.
Once that was signed, they knew it was all over. And therefore, the Mortils then applied for visas to leave Latvia, Sweden. They got to Sweden, and from there got visas to go to America. They left Europe the day before war broke out. They left on September 2nd, the day before war broke out in New York. Now, what happened with the Germans, the Russians arrived shortly afterwards, and Lydia's sister, the husband, Wilhelm Munters, deported to Russia, and Lydia and Wilhelm were in the gulag for 14 years. The children, terrible, terrible story. And Lydia's mother, fortunately, she had a Latvian passport. She actually survived the war in Riga. Then, towards the end of the war, she survived the beginning of the war, I should say, and she wasn't deported because of the passport, but she, in 1944, when the Russians came back, the Soviets came back, and everyone was so terrified of them, fled to Germany, and she disappeared in Germany. And that, she's another lost mother in this story. There's a lot of mothers in there. But it's a very, very tragic story, and very, very lucky that I get to have time to talk about it, but to discover the relatives of that family in Latvia, to discover some document memoirs, lots of photographs, and I've been able to use
where you thought we actually were today. Is it any really different today? You hear women say you can have a significant career and a husband, children, but you can't really have a significant career.
Well, I know people are saying that now. It's become part of the new fashion, but I really don't agree with that. I don't think it's true, and I don't think it should. We should talk ourselves into it. I think it's perfectly possible, and plenty of people do it. I think maybe what's a bit different is with artists. You know, I have sort of talked about a few artists in the book, but having a job as a executive in a bank, not quite the same. It might be terrible hours and all the rest of it, but it's not quite the same all-consuming thing that being an artist is. And I think the question about, you know, being an artist and being a mother is still a hugely the same with, you know, being a writer. A lot of writers, you know, find it very difficult to mind doing writing and having families. I think that's still a very live, ongoing discussion, and people are finding different ways to deal with it. But when it comes to, sort of regular jobs, I am worried about this backlash of people saying, I'll talk to you, I can't do it.
Nikki Gemmell's done very well as a writer, as a mother of three young children now. Kate Grenfell's done that.
Kate has great stories about how she did it, writing the stories on slivers of boxes of Panadol in the car while she went to the kids at school, and she had all these things you have to do, you can't just grab the moment.
The lines in view, if you become, from this story, if you become an impoverished widow, that's the way to go, isn't it?
Well, in some ways, though, it was... in some ways, then, it was harder for Jane Austen. I mean, Jane Austen didn't even have a room to go and write in, and yet she managed to do it. So, in some extent, it may not be for everyone, but it's certainly possible to do it.
Now, have I missed anyone? So, who wants to have the last go?
Too much to say already. I want to know what made you do it.
Yeah.
Was it the painting? Was the painting looking down at you from the wall?
I think that's what got me started. I mean, I felt.
Tell us about how you got started.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning that seeing this painting on my wall and seeing it differently, partly because I think my mother was dead and I was feeling very. She died very, very suddenly, so there was no chance to, have the dinner. And so I guess I felt a kind of an emotional connection to the painting and knew there was a very interesting story behind it, how it came to be painted, how my family found it, all of that. The fact that I lived in a house with a painting on the wall, when I was a teenager. I'd at home and then she was watching over me. So there are all these kind of, completely extraordinary elements to the story as it was, and people kept saying, it'd be a great story, why don't you write it? And so I thought, well, why not? But then as it developed, it became so much more. Constance Stokes became such a major character in it, and then Lydia Mortel, who knew even knew she existed, but suddenly her story, became by far the most interesting in the book, in my opinion, also the most tragic. But to me, it's become also a very interesting story about Australia, about the sorts of people that live here and who come here and, the stories they bring with them and the things that happen. And so, the book has became much more than I thought it would be when I started out. And I found that just really, really, really interesting. I really loved it. Loved doing it.
So that's where your book starts. And where does your book conclude? I guess that other painting hasn't been found.
No.
Do you think about that much?
Well, look, I'm sure it's on a wall somewhere in Melbourne. Probably in a Catholic, somewhere, I don't know.
You put it out in the Catholic Weekly, you might.
Certainly, I've had something in The Age, trying to advertise it.
Protestants read The Age.
I'm hoping now that with all the sort of chatter that the book creates, maybe somebody will
dig it up.
See, look up the whole thing.
Well,
go for the holy name months without going. Hang on, we've got to finish. We're very brief.
Sorry, yep. I just wonder, will she get now a place amongst the Australian women artists? Has she got a, have you established now?
Well, I can't be told that, but I would hope. One good thing I've learned, a couple of things, National Gallery of Australia, which has 6 strokes, mm-hmm. and now going to hang them for the first time, so that's good. Mm-hmm. And they last really come down to Canberra later this year and give a talk on why she deserves to be, you know, more known. I just heard today that there's a little gallery in Adelaide that's just suddenly got a mini Stokes exhibition going at the moment. They've had some in their sale room. So,
are you going to show your own pen?
Who knows? Well, I did show the other night at a launch in Sydney.
But Canberra, is it going to go for that?
Oh, I'll take it down for the talk, yes. Yes,
definitely. Is it final for Sydney?
I was just going to ask, has all this given you the urge to meet some of the people in person that you
know? Oh, yes. I've met every single person who's still alive.
Oh, yeah.
Well, with the exception of the Romanov connection lady in Hawaii. I haven't met her, but we're in constant email contact. And, there are some very bizarre twists and turns in this story. I've met a huge number of extraordinary people. Because the Mortill family is the one that's a very large family. Even Mortill himself had no children. He and Lydia had no children. And he had no children of his own from his previous marriage. The woman he stole. She had children, and those children are alive and are in contact with them.
Many thanks,
Anne.
Thank
you.
Well, I'll be very brief. It's great to have Anne Summers back again. I think the last time you were here was probably your volume one of your memoirs, I think. But you've been here quite a few times. And I'm one of these old-fashioned types. I mean, I'm pretty pleased that Mrs. Summers had some children, actually. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had a speaker on Sunday. Whole night without a speaker. And I guess the other person is probably pretty pleased from wherever she is that Mrs. Summers had a number of children, particularly one of them is Constance Stokes, because what you've been able to do, and this is quite a fascinating tale, is to restore a prominent Australian artist to a place she probably should have had and didn't have. And that's something I guess you never thought about when you saw the picture on the wall. Did you see it at Tate Gregan?
Mm.
You saw it there. Mm. And then, of course, in your own. So I think that's a fascinating tale today. Anything that will always get me in that sort of includes something about the Battle of the Somme, something about our precious Daniel Mann. Most importantly, remembering the Nazi Soviet pact. So I'm delighted we had put all those together, plus Mrs. Summers, who to me looks a bit of a sword, I must say. And it's great to have a daughter back. So well done, Anne, and I hope the book goes well.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.